This talk comes from www.euroleadershipresources.org. The European Leadership Forum is a bridge between local Christian leaders' needs and God's global resources. Hundreds of hours of key Christian thinking. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org and sign up to receive details of more resources that can support your ministry.
This is great. So we will be together all week. We will form a group and we will hear each other's questions and hear each other's answers and each other's confusions and learn something about each other's situations in terms of Christians in society, living in the world but not of the world, with a particular emphasis on arts and creativity, which are very much misunderstood, misused, and vilified by Christians over the last century, at least, perhaps. And we hope maybe to have a better biblical worldview of the arts. How should Christians relate to the arts? I am not an artist, except I used to be a musician, which is a very sad thing to say. But I love the arts, and I feel very strongly their value. And mostly, I am one who relates to the arts. And this is what I like to talk about. Not how we do art, but how we relate to the arts, how we receive the arts, how we interact with the arts, how we hear the arts, how we answer the arts. Because that is for every Christian, whether you're a painter or a sculptor or a musician or whatever you might be, you all relate to the arts. You all hear music. You all see buildings. You all see paintings. You probably all see films. All of those are art forms. And as Christians, we need to love our neighbors. Is Woody Allen your neighbor? Well, I think according to the parable of the Good Samaritan, he is. So how do you love Woody Allen? That's a legitimate question for the Christian life. That is my burden. How do we love Woody Allen or Picasso or Arvo Pärt or Liviu Mokan? How do we love the artists in our world and who have been in our world? Before I get carried away and give you some kind of content, I would like you all to say who you are, where you come from, and something about why you're interested in this track. And I will hold the microphone out to you so that you will be perpetuated. What you say is forever.
That's a risky thing to do because your line is short.
But my feet are long.
My name is Jeff Fountain. I'm from Holland. I am the European Director for Youth with a Mission and very much involved with Hope for Europe, which is a network of networks that have been developing over the last 10 years or so. And that's enough.
Okay. Andrzej Turkanik. I am a former musician myself, so I am able to extend to you my sympathies, and I would expect that in return. Well, actually, from a theologian's network, what I sneaked out.
Welcome.
I'm Phil Lawson Johnston. I'm a glass engraver. I'm also a songwriter and a worship leader, so I'm very interested in what you have to say.
Jim Barnes, Library Director of Prague Christian Library. I'm a history major and very interested in the interaction of history, society, and the arts.
Thank you.
My name is Kirill. I'm from Moscow, and I'm working as a catering company manager, and also I'm a church administrator, so Christianity and society is very interesting for me, as to two different things have to, that we can put together and to study.
I'm Vaso Skostradovaki. I'm from Greece. I'm a graphic designer, and I work with children and church and in camps with art. We do art programs with children and several things.
Thank you.
My name is Craig Jefferson. I'm from Scotland, currently studying painting in the Art College in Edinburgh. I'm also involved in student ministry in Edinburgh.
My name is Lincoln, and I guess I'm from Edinburgh. And I guess my main interest is recently I have really been getting into film, and it's one of my kind of evangelistic opportunities as I run a film club that kind of looks to discuss films and go from there.
My name is Sarah. I live in Bratislava, Slovakia, and I'm involved in a work of helping strengthen the church as they bridge the gap between the reality of Christ and everyday life, so the gospel in society, of which art is part.
Peter Sinak, also from Bratislava, we work together with Sarah.
Andrej Garaj from Slovakia. I'm responsible for a mission agency. Mission and society is a very important relationship.
My name is Andrew Gorbachenko. I'm from Kyiv, from Ukraine, and I work in a Christian organization. It's called Realis, and it's really similar to the Senate. We have the idea of bringing the reality of Christ to the secular world. So the that's all.
Hey, my name is Raul Todinca. I'm from Romania. I'm a pastor in a Baptist church, and one of my responsibilities in this church is worship, and I'm very interested in music, so we want to outreach the society through music, and for this reason I attend this course.
My name is Mark Sterling. I'm from Edinburgh originally, but currently studying in Covenant Seminary in St. Louis. Was involved in student ministry before going there, and in a past life was a doctor as well. But I guess the burden for me has become seeing people living a bit of a world view in every part of life, and not just in church going and devotional life. So that's why.
Thank you.
My name is Livio Mokan. I'm a very, very serious person.
You're right.
And also I try to remain a child and to play. And my game with my daddy is sculpturing.
I'm a university lecturer, and I teach graphic design, visual communication, and digital media in a journalism department. Includes Romania.
She's serious too. She's my wife.
Well, somebody in the family has to be serious. And also win a bread.
I'm Bill Edgar, old friend of Ellis and Vim's, and I'm an academic. I teach in a theological seminary in Philadelphia as a professor of apologetics. That's my secret disguise. What I really do is play in a jazz band.
Barbara Edgar, wife of the jazz pianist. I teach theological French at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. My Christian life was started under the care of Ellis Potter at LaBrie many, many years ago, and so I'm thrilled to be here.
Hi, my name's Rachel Pangborn, and I work for the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students in the UK. Producing audiovisual material.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Then we have somebody very important.
Yes. But also shy. So I respect that because I'm married to a shy woman, and I understand. It's very interesting to hear the introductions. Last year, we were about the same number of people, maybe a few more. More than half of the people were medical doctors. And it shaped our thinking of how to use the material. So now we know a little bit how you are, and it will give us an idea how to present our thoughts so that we can interact together. The notes for this lecture are not on the right page because they were supposed to be tomorrow morning. So they're on Monday for the first lecture. The notes do not correspond exactly to what I will say, so you don't have to be too concerned about finding the page. I will not do the main teaching for you. I will make an introduction and ask a couple of questions and maybe set a mood of stress and tension for us as we move into the week. The name of the little lecture that I would like to give is a question. Is art a commodity or a relationship? And art is very often thought of as a commodity, something that you buy or possess, that you buy a movie ticket, or you buy a painting, or you buy a CD, or you buy a piece of clothing that you possess. And Christians are concerned about the arts in terms of their use. How do we use the arts, and how do the arts affect us? A concept that I'm working with very recently and trying to develop a lecture is another question. Is life what we do or what happens to us? And I think this pertains to the arts, to our relating to the arts. Is art what happens to us, and is our responsibility to filter it? Or is art a relationship in which we are fully actively engaged, and is our responsibility to love? You probably will guess part of my answer, that our responsibility, as I understand the Bible and the gospel, is to love and to be actively involved in the society around us, and not only to filter what comes in so as to be safe. Because Christianity is not safe. It's real. It's a battle. It's being little children. Little children aren't safe. They're in constant danger because of their curiosity and because of their trust in things that maybe they shouldn't even trust in, like playing in the road or eating whatever looks interesting. Their life is not safe, but their life is full of rapid learning and intense engagement. And Jesus said, we must become like little children in order to be in the kingdom of heaven. And I think he probably meant that if we are not like little children, we can't be in the kingdom of heaven. And if we would sneak in, we wouldn't like it. Because that's what it is like. If we would sneak in as very sophisticated, adult, stable, solid people, we would not be comfortable in the kingdom of heaven, because the kingdom of heaven is like little children, learning, trusting, asking, finding out, tasting, and seeing. So we want to have a godly approach to the arts, but we live in a society which is a very commercial society. And the commercial nature of our society has been, in a way, the salt and the light of the church, influencing or infecting, as you will, the church with a commercial worldview, so that we view the arts commercially. What should we pay for that is useful? What should we consume that is a blessing or edifying to us? And the center of all of those questions is me. This is the center of commercialism. The motivating factors in advertising are pride and greed. And that comes to be very often the motivating factors in Christians relating to the arts. Pride, including protectionism, and greed, what do we consume that we enjoy? Now, we come to talk about art in society and a biblical worldview. And so there are questions that come to mind. And the first question comes to my mind is, what is art? And there are long discussions over the centuries about what is art, and I don't know that we've come to any very clear definition so far, but I would like to offer a definition which over the years has tended to cause several days of violent rioting among the participants. But I don't hesitate to offer it to you because I think we might have a lively discussion. My understanding of art is that it is deliberate human action. Deliberate human action. Now, some of you may be thinking that's very broad. That's a very big circle you're drawing here. And all kinds of things that we don't normally associate with art are going to go in there. Yes, you're right. But consider what is left out of the circle. All accident is left out because it is deliberate. Art is something that you do. It is something that you choose. It is something for which you are responsible. So it's not anything that happens to you. It's not a circumstance. It's not an inspiration. It's something deliberate, something for which you are responsible. And it's human. It's not what God does. What God does is very beautiful. The sunset, the mountains, the meadows, the beautiful structure of the molecules and the crystals. It's beautiful and inspiring, and it is a foundation and a framework for our creative activity, but I leave it out when I talk about art. I only have what humans do in the circle, and this simplifies and reduces a lot so that we can focus on this part of creativity, the human part. And the last word, action, it isn't a dream or a vision or an inspiration or an idea. It's something that you do. It's not something that you feel, although feeling is involved. Vision is involved. Inspiration is involved, necessarily involved. But it isn't art until it's done. It's something that you make or sing or write or dance or shoot or act or give facial expression to or imitate. It's something that you do. So it is deliberate human action. And many people have asked that the word creative be put in to that. And I understand the motivation of it, but I would rather leave it out and say that it can also be destructive. Because I don't want to assume that all deliberate human action that is artistic is godly. Some of it is very destructive. Some of it is anti-creative and deliberately reductionistic in human life. But it is still deliberate human action. And as we confront and relate to the arts, we find many negative things. We find many destructive things. We find many dehumanizing things made by humans. So it is a human, deliberately responsible, dehumanizing action. And it is art. And so it goes into our circle. So just to give the extreme parameter, premeditated first-degree murder is art. Accidental homicide is not. Okay? That's just so we really know it's a big circle. And I'm not talking about any particular thing. Yes, and many artists should be locked away. Artistry and godliness don't equal each other. They're not corresponding terms. It's human in a fallen world to sin and to be destructive, and it can be done artistically or accidentally Well, I'm not interested in the accidental destructiveness of people. I'm interested in the artistic destructiveness of people. How do we understand that? And how do we love and respond to the destructive people? This, to me, is a gospel question. This, to me, is an apologetic and evangelistic question. How do we love and respond to the artist, the Woody Allen, the Stravinsky, the whoever it is that we speak about? Another word is entertainment. People often use the arts as entertainment. Film, music, some kinds of paintings, decor, graphics, as entertainment. And the English word comes from Latin, intertenere or intertenuto, which means to hold between. And what entertains holds us between this active responsible part of our life and the next active responsible part of our life in a kind of a limbo of irresponsible pleasure, where entertainment is something that happens to me. Is life what I do or what happens to me? Entertainment is what happens to me. And I leave that out of art, and I often warn against particularly excessive entertainment. Although entertainment can be very useful as a therapy or a medication. If you have a lot of stress, you can have a little entertainment, or you can take Valium. And they both can be effective. And one might be better than the other in any given case. But I wouldn't want to treat entertainment any less seriously than I would treat the Valium. I would want to take it seriously and to say, this is a therapy and a medicine, and this is not something to which I am entitled or something that I should bathe in most of the time to be entertained. Entertainment is like elevator music, muzak, that just creates an ambiance or an atmosphere that makes us feel happier or somehow pleased or provided for. It's like a soma. And it can be very delightful, and it can be a part of artistic involvement, and perhaps should be a part of artistic involvement. But if it becomes isolated, it's less human than I hope we will all be, to be entertained. A third word, I'm sorry, I'm rushing right along. I need to leave time for discussion. A third word is taste. Many people tell me, oh, I don't know anything about art, but I know what I like. Have you ever heard this? People often say it, and they say it as if after great research and study, they have discovered and established what it is that they like. And they are proud of knowing this. And they think this is a justification for much of their artistic activity and involvement and consumption. But I think this is not a truly human thing to know what we like. A geranium knows what it likes. I live in Switzerland. We have geraniums in our window. And they show us every day what they like. They like the sunshine and they like the water. And if you don't give them what they like, they won't be beautiful. How many of you bake bread? Really? How many of you eat bread? I said, okay. Most of you probably know that in order to bake bread, you have to use yeast. Yes? Little one-celled asexual organisms. Okay? They know what they like. They like warm and moist and sweet. Dark is nice, but optional. They like these things, and they know that. And if you give them what they like, they will make the bread get big. If you don't give them what they like, the bread will be flat. So when you have arrived at the accomplishment of knowing what you like, you have arrived at the level of a one-celled asexual organism. But I believe that you are made in the image of God and that you are human beings and you are very different from one-celled asexual organisms, and that this reductionism to life by taste is ungodly and dehumanizing, and that we should resist it, and we should work with all our might and all our hearts to help our neighbors to resist this reduction to taste. Because it's always my taste. It always centers on me. And anything that centers on me cannot be love, because love is other-centered. And God is love. So to be godly is to be other-centered. And the taste only centers on me. We need to make two confessions, I believe, as we approach the arts. And one is that often I dislike what is good. Something is noble, excellent, well-made, skillful, technically very fine, with a lot of integrity, internal and external, and objectively really a fine thing. And I don't like it, because it's my taste. So what is good, I don't like, often. And on the other hand, there are works of art that are sloppy, derivative, unoriginal, lazy, technically poor, half accidental, and they're my favorite things in all the world. I just love them. Because my taste is bad, and I can prove it to myself quickly just by considering what universal aesthetic criteria there might be and asking, how do I relate to those things? Well, we all need to confess we have bad taste. And if we follow our taste, we will go in a wrong way. Of course, our taste is very precious to us, and it cannot be ignored, because it is a part of who we are. But we are broken and sinful people, and we should not worship our taste or learn from our taste. Our taste will not teach us anything. We're just learning from our own experience or our own pleasure or our own egotism. We only learn things that come from the outside. In Bratislava, where some of my colleagues have come from, I gave a lecture a couple of times called "What Kind of Music Does God Like?" Most of my lectures have questions as titles. And, of course, the first answer that we all know is that God likes the kind of music that I like. Everybody knows that in their heart. Now, if we get out of our hearts into the real world, we might discover that God's taste and my taste are slightly different. And maybe there is some adjusting and growing that might happen in my life. Well, this is a very joyful and very painful and very frightening possibility. And we want to encourage you in all of that. The joy, the pain, the fear, the growth, as you relate as Christians to the society around you. Christian parents often ask me, what kind of films should I let my children see? What kind of music should I let my children listen to? And it's a question that's motivated by love and care and a desire to protect the children and guide them in good ways. It's a well-motivated question. But I think it's also somehow a wrong question, because it is a question of diet. What they want to know is, what films and music or literature can my children consume that will be edifying or a healthy diet for them? It's a question of diet. It's a question of consumption, of commercializing and consuming the art that is around. And I don't want to suggest that children should not be protected, but to maybe take a different angle on how to protect them. And a question that comes to my mind is, can we protect ourselves or our children by avoiding? Or can we more protect ourselves by education, by learning, by interacting, by discerning what we relate to? And I think the second one is a greater protection. If we teach a child to avoid certain kinds of films or music, it's like giving a hungry person a fish. But if we teach a child to discern what is said in films and music and painting and literature, and to respond to it and to understand what is being said, it's like giving a hungry person a fishing pole and a line and a hook and bait, and teaching them the technique so that they can have food for themselves and go on learning and feeding and growing and being nourished as human beings. So, although I know we need protection, and those in authority need to protect those under their authority, that part of the protection is in education and in teaching discernment and engagement rather than avoidance, so that we can be in the world but not of the world. And we do have a natural tendency to be out of the world in our own holy huddle, but motivated by the principles of the world, of commercialism and consumption. So we find ourselves living the opposite of what Jesus said. We are out of the world, but of the world. And here in this track, we want to help each other to be in the world, Christians in society, but not of the world, of the values of the world, the commercialism and the consumption and the self-centered. Now, often the art that we relate to is very painful, full of complaints and suffering and falsehood and difficult questions and painful statements. And this is quite true. But if art is a human expression, a human communication, rather than a product like Andy Warhol's tomato soup can or something else that you would buy and consume, if it is a human communication, avoiding the art that is not edifying would be like deciding, I will never have a conversation with a drug addict or a prostitute or an alcoholic or a homosexual, because their conversation is almost certainly not going to be edifying. And so if I consume human communication and expression, and my job as a Christian is to filter it, then I will avoid carefully certain kinds of people who are not edifying, who are full of pain and full of complaints and full of confusion. I will avoid those people so that I can live a holy life separate. But I don't think this is the biblical picture. I don't think this is how we are obedient to the gospel of Jesus Christ and to the Great Commission, by avoiding. Of course, Christians are often called to deal closely with the drug addicts and the pregnant mothers and the prostitutes and the alcoholics and the homosexuals and all kinds of people who have terrible distortions and problems and who cry out in pain and rage against the difficulties and the frustrations of life. We are called to relate to those people in crisis pregnancy centers and drop-in centers and all kinds of Homosexuals Anonymous work and different kinds of things. We know this as Christians, but when people express themselves artistically with many kinds of distortions and pains and frustrations, how do we relate to that? Do we avoid it? Do we consume it? Do we reject it? Do we rebuke it? Or do we listen to it and pray about it and formulate an answer? Do we try to love and understand what is being said, even if it's not nice? What is our approach? Yes, we must become like little children. Little children are awful. I mean, in the sense that they're full of awe, but they're also awful, but they're full of wonder about life. And they're excited about everything. A leaf. Oh, a bug. Oh, something ugly. I put it in my mouth. And they're really very excited about life. And they're full of energy and curiosity. And they ask questions. When I was young, adults said to me, "You must not ask questions, dear. You must just believe. You must have faith like a little child and not ask questions." And when I was a child, I believed that because adults with authority said it to me. But when I became an adult, I realized how totally absurd that is. Because how many of you ever knew a little child who did not ask questions? Do they exist? I mean, healthy ones? They don't. This is their job. This is what they do all day long, is ask questions. It's their profession. And so when we become like little children, that's our profession. We're asking questions. Why do little children ask so many questions? What gives them the freedom to do that? Faith. They trust mommy and daddy. I remember Barry Segrin's son, Andrew, when we were living in Waymo. Andrew was 3, and they were all in the garden, and they were digging, and a worm was cut in half. And Andrew picked up and came to Barry and said, "Daddy fix?" Because Daddy fixed everything. Daddy fixed. Now, this is faith. You see, this is faith, the faith of a little child. And so he could ask this question. He could dare to ask this question. He had the courage and the hope and the imagination to ask this amazing question, "Daddy fix?" Well, this is what we say to God every day when we come to him with our broken lives. "Daddy fix?" Well, of course, God can fix. Barry couldn't actually fix the worm. I'm sure he did his best. He's a very... very faithful man, but he couldn't fix the worm, but God can fix everything. And so we should be asking these questions. But children, in their growing, experience frustration, failure, disappointment, deceit. People tell them wrong answers. People lie to them. People deceive them. People manipulate them. And because of the pain of these experiences, they withdraw and they build a shell around themselves to protect themselves. We call this maturity or sophistication. We have all kinds of euphemisms to apply to this process of death. And we reward it and we admire it and we are proud of it in the futility of our burnt out imaginations. But we want to turn this around so that we don't admire and reward death. We don't encourage dying, but we encourage living, healing, breaking out of the shell in new faith and trust and the wonder of little children. Little children test reality. A child might crawl under this table and decide to stand up. Stand up, and bang, the top of their head crashes against the table. Oh, that's a very frustrating experience, because my idea is stand up. This is my vision and my calling. Stand up. This is my purpose and my telos. I will now stand up. Crash. I want to try it again. This can't be true. And they try it again. And then it really hurts. And so they begin to cry and they scream. But it's not only the pain. It's the frustration. It's the limitation on their imagination that makes them so angry. Because their idea cannot be fulfilled. But little children are much more intelligent than adults because they dare to push against the table. They dare to push the limits of reality, to test, to see. And by the time we become adults, we have stopped all that. We become mature, sophisticated, adult. We no longer test the limits of reality. We're no longer young, learning, growing, experimenting people. We have become very settled and still, like a still pond with the scum rising to the top. And we need to be fresh with living water, with life and childlike wonder and courage and joy in exploring reality. Creativity comes from God because God is creative. We learn it in the first chapter of the Bible. It does not come from the devil. The devil is the opposite of creative. Creativity is dividing, defining, naming. And the devil's function is consuming and reducing and unifying. We are creative because God is creative. But we must not worship our creativity. And this has often happened in human life. People worship their artistic creativity or that of others. They worship scientific creativity or that of others instead of worshiping God, the source of our creativity. Many non-Christians who are made in the image of God are wonderfully creative. And I think this we must acknowledge. Here is a Picasso, not a close friend of God, as I understand, who was amazingly creative. Why? Because he was made in the image of God. We should rejoice in that. Beethoven was also not a close friend of God, if the historians are correct. But he was wonderfully creative. When I listen to Beethoven, I almost always weep. Because I think, oh, such glory and such hell. Such glory, such a glorious expression and no thankfulness. How deeply, deeply sad. But it doesn't mean that I avoid Beethoven because he was not thankful and he didn't write Solo Dei Gloria at the bottom of his manuscripts like Bach did, and I'm very glad that Bach wrote that. But I don't say, therefore, I will listen to Bach and I will not listen to Beethoven. I don't make that decision on that basis. I listen to Beethoven because he has important things to say, and he's very stimulating. Not all that he says is godly. Much of it is very humanistic, very proud, very manipulative, violent. But I need to hear it and to realize, aha, here is the creativity of God that is perhaps expressed in destructive ways. And I must understand, why does he say that? Imagine, now which picture shall I give? I'm very fond of questions. And in terms of relating to the arts in society, I want to encourage more questions than information. If, as we have time together, you'll discover I don't know very much. My ignorance will astonish you with its profundity. It is really impressive. But I do have an interest in stimulating questions so that we can open up windows and begin to find out some things. I think it's more important to ask questions than to give answers. If you would get on a bus in the city where you live, and you would see two empty seats in the front, and you would shout out, "Jesus is the answer!" And then you sit down. And you wait for someone to come and sit next to you and say, "Oh, tell me about this Jesus." It might happen. But you might have plenty of time to read the paper. and plenty of privacy. But if you would get on the bus and say, "What are your questions?" and sit down, it is very likely that someone would sit next to you and say, "You strange person, what do you mean? What are your questions? What are you talking about?" You see, that shouting is inviting. And Jesus is the answer is offensive. Because it implies, I don't care what your questions are. Don't bother me with your questions. Just buy Jesus. I'm here to sell Jesus. And your questions don't matter. Whatever they might be, who cares? Jesus is the answer. I don't think that's a good beginning with the arts or with people. But it's better to say, what are your questions? Who are you? What are your joys and hopes? Where do you hurt? Let me stand beside you as a human being and face life together. This is inviting. And then as you face life together and you get to know the person, then questions will come up for which the only possible answer is Jesus. Then you preach. You don't begin by selling Jesus. You begin by loving the people, which means you care about them. And this is the artist. By caring about what did they say? What are their questions? How can those questions be understood, processed? How can we speak about Jesus and the whole gospel from the Bible in a way that addresses the questions of the arts? Now, we're limited on time. I wanted to look at this painting, but I don't think we have really time to look at this painting. It's a Polish painting. Did you know that? But you are very interested in it, so that's interesting to me. We have two choices. We can have a discussion or we can talk about this painting. Would you rather ask questions or would you rather look at this painting?
Painting.
Fine.
Try to do both.
Yes, you're very encouraging.
Ask questions about painting.
Ask questions about the painting. Can you all see it, or is it too glary? Let me try to. Does that help at all? That was helpful.
Okay.
But are you okay over here? Everyone can see it. Okay. Tell me, please, what do you see? Be free to get up and move around the room. What do you see in the painting?
Flower.
You see a flower. It is an egg. You must be free to get up and come and put your hand on the painting or your nose. Or, a door?
Yeah, I think there's too much glare. Let's push this up like that.
Is that better? Is that good? Okay. Okay.
Maybe stand it up a little bit.
And now this is art. I think it's better. Good. Okay. A door. Object. An egg. A flower. Yes?
I see colors.
You see colors.
It's predominantly very black, but of course the egg stands right out, so does the dead red tulip.
Yes.
Is it a tulip?
It's a tulip. You live in Holland. Anything else? A what?
Light.
You see night?
Light.
Light, yes, good.
A jug.
A vase.
Open door.
Open door.
We're inside looking outside.
You're
looking from quite a low position.
Yes. You are.
Standing
You are. That's very interesting. Do you see that or do you feel it? It's an interesting combination. You see sadness. That's very interesting because it's difficult to see sadness. We feel sadness. Sadness is somehow a deeper experience. But what we see with our eyes are objective things. It can produce a sadness. It can produce a sadness. Now, this is a key point because many people say, I see or I feel sadness. And this is a painting of the greatest possible joy. And when we look carefully, we will see and feel the joy when we have looked objectively at the painting. But when we look at the first and we have our subjective reaction, it is sad or depressed or dark or somehow pressing. But when we begin to look carefully to see not what do I feel, not how do I react, but what is in the painting, what does the painter say, and not how do I react to it, I think you will have a different feeling, actually, which is partly because of the light, but because of many things. Now, you see well. Did you see the spider web? Okay, nobody said it, but I guess you can see quite a bit. Do you see dead branches? Yes, okay. Now, I know the painter, and I know his style and his painting. So I am a resource person. And I would like you to ask me what questions, circumstantial questions, not meaning questions. Do you understand? Ask me whatever you want that would help you to understand this painting and its context.
What motivates the painter?
Now that's a why question. Ask me fact questions. Yes. He did paint in his studio. This is his door, his table, his egg, or the neighbor's egg, his vase.
Is he alive now?
He is alive now.
Is he healthy?
No.
Is he handicapped in terms that he cannot walk out of the house?
How do you see that? He's agoraphobic. He's agoraphobic, severely. He's a Christian, and he asked me one day, can a person be a Christian and not go to church? And one day I would preach in Warsaw, and he phoned the church, and he said, could you save me the seat on the end of the back row, and will you leave the door open through the whole meeting so that I can come? And they did, and he came to church, but normally he cannot. He cannot.
So that is the door of his studio.
Mm-hmm.
And he put across the door that table as an obstacle.
The table covers the whole painting. You can't go around it in the painting.
And you cannot get out.
And you can't go out.
Physically, just visually.
Because of this table. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that arrests your attention to the egg, which of course symbolizes something embryonic, something a promise, shall we say. But then the flower that's dead, there's such a strong red there, it's not totally dead.
No. What? Now, let me ask you questions, because we so have so little time. What color is the flower?
Red.
What side of the painting is the flower on?
The left.
The left. Do left and red suggest anything to you? In Poland, in 1981. Communism. What is the relationship of the communism to the table?
It's below the surface, so it's past.
It's dying. It's falling off.
It's not dead yet.
No, it's beautiful. It's the most luscious thing on the surface in the whole world.
But it is dying.
It is dying. It's cut off. And it's falling off. It's rejected in a way. It's the lowest thing in the painting. And the most beautiful in terms of luscious color and delicious, inviting kind of image.
You suggested that it represents communism, but does not represent what communism has done to life. It's cut off the flower from its roots.
It could also that. That's right. That's right. Here is an egg. Can you see closely the egg? Does someone need to come up and look really closely at this egg? There is a hole in the egg. Was the hole made from the outside or from the inside? Come, don't be shy. Come and look at the egg. Tell me about that egg. It looks like a little window was opened and someone is looking out from this egg.
The same as he does from his studio.
Yes, yes.
But did he tell you that the flower is for him just a symbol of communism? Or it's more than that?
No, he wouldn't tell me anything. He and I disagree very strongly. He believes that it is wrong to apply words to paintings. I asked him the meaning of something sometime, and he said, if I wanted to write a poem, I would have written, but since I've made a painting, would you be good enough to look at it? But then I wrote an introduction for a vernissage of his work, and he wrote to me, and he said, if I would ever apply words to my paintings, I would choose your words. So he was very kind.
I asked this question because for me, that flower, that red flower, is much more than a government or a...
It's deeper.
It's life itself that is red, which is a symbol of blood, of life. Yeah. But also a life that has an end here inside of the studio.
Yeah.
And we watch the universe outside of our life that has an end.
Now, so the egg is hatching. Here is some color, some blue color. What do you think that is? You think it's a new day. Some people think the day is ending, because sometimes it looks like that at the end of the day. Most people think the day is beginning. It's just before the sun comes up. And the egg is in the middle of the new day. What time of year is it?
Spring.
Tulips in the spring. Here is a vase. What kind of a vase is it? It's a Grecian urn. And what do you put in urns? Ashes. Fireplace ashes? The ashes of the dead. So here's a symbol of death. And the branches coming out of it are dead, which is appropriate. Here are little red berries. Do you recognize those berries? They're hagebutten, cynegodon, rose hips. What shape are the berries? They're not round. They're drops. And what color are they? Red. What shade of red? Blood red. The drops of blood. Do you know hagebutten rosehip plants? Have you seen them? They have thorns. How big are the thorns of the hagebutten? Do you remember? They're like fuzz. The tiny, tiny little white fuzz on the green branch. Here are thorns. And they're this long. It's surreal. It's not a photograph. It's a painting. And it's in a style called mystical realism. And so he puts these exaggerated thorns. Now, where are the drops of blood and particularly the thorns in relationship to the egg? They're over. So we have thorns and drops of blood over the egg. Does that suggest anything? Spring, new day, new life, thorns and drops of blood. It's a crown of thorns. It's an Easter painting. It was exhibited in a government exhibit in Poznan in 1982 and was given a large cash prize by the communist government because they don't know how to read paintings. They knew it was technically excellent, but they didn't understand that it was an anti-communist, pro-life, pro-Jesus resurrection painting with no crosses in it. So this is a kind of a primitive example because it's basically representational. But just to get all of us out of only how do I react and into what does the painter say? What does he put? How can I understand what I actually see? And then I come to joy. When I first look at the painting, I see, well, it's basically very dark. This is true. Most of it is black. That's very depressing, very dark. But when we look and understand, we realize in 1981, Poland was in darkness. This was the reality in which he lived. But he's painting this amazing joy. The death of the beautiful prison and evil, the new life just beginning, the going out. And of course, it's for himself as an agoraphobic. But it isn't only for him. It's for the whole world. It's for the nation that he paints. Here is the new life. Oh, we have 1 minute. Good. Shall we stop and drink coffee? And then Bill Edgar will be next. This is the only time I'm going to get to talk to you, but I'll be here so we can see each other and we can discuss anything we like during the rest of the week. Good. Thank you very much, and God bless you.